Well, I want to thank you all for coming, and thank also the people in the hall for coming. I'm sorry there wasn't room for everyone, though I'm pleased there's so much interest. I have to make a little correction to begin with. My master's was from the University of Quebec at Montreal, and UQAM, the kind of freedom of scholarship allowed there, was very important. There is a difference between UQAM and the University of Montreal. I guess I should get right into the topic. I've got to present a book that includes a lot of complicated and maybe somewhat startling ideas for some people. Because what I found in the course of my research was that people have forgotten a lot about what the traditional British Constitution was. However, in the course of my research, I was dealing a lot with especially members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. We know them better as Iroquois. And they've been dealing with the people that ended up making Canada and the United States for centuries. And they've had to go through many changes in the political order that we live under, or that our ancestors lived under, or the ancestors, the people who established Canada, lived under. The title of the book is Ghost Dancing with Colonialism. And the ghost dance began among indigenous peoples in the United States who were having difficulty dealing with their colonization. And it was a kind of spiritual response where they were just trying to deal with what happened. However, when we understand ghosts from our culture, there's also a sense of being haunted by the past. And I think that has more to do with the title. It's the Supreme Court of Canada that is haunted by ghosts of the past that it doesn't really quite understand too well. My research began with a study of the application for a membership in the League of Nations that was made by the Haudenosaunee. The representative overseas was Levi General Descahé. Descahé is a title somewhat like Master of the Rolls in British court, or maybe Prime Minister, or it's just a title. It's the name of an original member of the Confederacy, but it wasn't his personal name, it was his position name. And just to notice in passing, this will be significant as things go on. You can see a copy of the two-row wampum on his knee as he's advocating in Europe. And the two-row wampum is something that represents an important principle in intercultural relations. It's the principle of non-interference in the affairs of other countries. Here, this is a photograph of an earlier generation of Haudenosaunee Rodianer. They call their representatives Rodianer, or Royaner for one. It usually is translated into English as chiefs, but their role is not at all like a chief. In our way of thinking in English, a chief is at the top of a hierarchical concept of society, and their model for social order is not hierarchical. I'll have a little bit of that later. I began Ghost Dancing with Colonialism, the book, with this quote from Madame Justice LaRouse DeBay. If I read it, in light of the evolution of our laws following the passage of the charters, and given the growing recognition that there are many different perspectives, the Aboriginal perspective, for example, I believe that the era of concealed underlying premises is now over. In my view, those premises must be brought to the surface in order to promote consistency in our law and the integrity of our judicial system. Now, I doubt if she was aware of it, but in some ways, the idea of recognizing different perspectives is very basic to the British tradition. And in other ways, it's being forgotten. And as I looked into the issues that were raised by the situation, and I looked at cognitive theory, I began to realize that it is probably impossible for any of us to completely escape our underlying premises. So we need a bit of humility when we approach intercultural problems. This book is an invitation to explore intercultural differences and the problems that arise from them. And it's an invitation to explore unfamiliar intellectual terrain that was referred to in one of the quotes that I used at the beginning of the book. The cases that I used to study the reasoning of the judges were mostly cases that interpreted Section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982, which says that the existing Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada are recognized and affirmed. That's the statement in law that the judges were working with. I don't think that in the end one can really say that there has been an affirmation of Indigenous rights. There hasn't been an understanding of the problems involved in doing that. One of the problems one confronts when, especially if one wants to take a positive view of Canadian law, is that there are a great deal of anomalies when it comes to the application of the law to Indigenous peoples. And there are also anomalies in the perceptions that people have. Stephen Harper made the news conveniently in the middle of my research by announcing that we have no history of colonialism in Canada. And by this time, I already knew that when Canada was named a Dominion of Canada, the Dominion of Canada, a dominion was defined as a colony. And a colony was defined as any part of His Majesty's dominions exclusive of the British Islands and British India. In fact, and I think this will be a surprise to most people and most lawyers, the Constitution Act 1867, which is the current name of the British North America Act, states that Canada's purpose is to promote the interests of the British Empire. The British Empire probably doesn't exist anymore. It's a bit of sloppiness in the drafting, or it reflects our failure to reflect on how deeply colonized we are. However, if we look back to the beginning of the last century, Canadians were very proud to be a British colony. And we see, for example, Wilfrid Laurier, a former Prime Minister of Canada, stating, "We are British subjects. Canada is one of the daughter nations of the Empire, and we realize to the full the rights and obligations which are involved in that proud title." So there's been a changing paradigm and a change in people's attitude that you can see if you contrast Stephen Harper's concept of Canada with Wilfrid Laurier's. Madam Justice McLaughlin, she, I'm sure, felt she was speaking for all Canadians when she said that respect for the inherent dignity and equality of human beings, tolerance of difference, and democratic freedoms are part of the social fabric. We certainly want it to be. However, when we take a look at the experience of Indigenous peoples, it's hard to support that vision. If we look back in legal history and we look at the legal treatment of Indigenous peoples, we can find, for example, that between 1876 and 1951, The Indian Act defined a person as an individual other than an Indian. So if you define indigenous people outside of humanity, in essence, then all these generous sayings become true. But it's hardly fair. This kind of thinking seems to have impacted on the interpretations given to the British North America Act. Section 9124 states that Indians and lands belonging to the Indians fall under the exclusive legislative authority of the Parliament of Canada. This has been interpreted as license for the Canadian Parliament to make laws for Indigenous people who, at the time that this was passed, did not have a vote in the Canadian Parliament, and to impose those laws on the Indigenous peoples. I don't think that's necessarily the original intention of the wording of that act that was passed by the British Parliament, because Section 91 deals with foreign affairs. And certainly it hasn't been interpreted that just because Canadian Parliament is to deal with aliens and with other states, that Canada has a right to make laws for them. A question I had to ask, because by the time I was looking into this, I knew a lot about Haudenosaunee history and how deeply tied these people were to the development of both Canada and the United States. And so I wondered why there wasn't a lot of objection that they didn't participate in the formation of the British North America Act. However, in the late 1800s, when Canada started to legislate for Indigenous peoples, many members of the Six Nations, as we saw in the earlier photographs of the wampum, started reminding people of the two-row wampum, or trying to remind them, which stands for the principle. People usually say the two rows. The rows represent the paths of two ships, the British ship and the Indigenous canoe, people say. I have one thing that says that that was a British interpretation of the two-row wampum, but that each was to look after their own internal affairs and not to interfere with the other. And in fact, Britain did follow that policy in the early years when people were meeting and when the majority of the population in eastern Canada was still Indigenous. It's only as the population shifted that the interpretation shifted. Somehow, Indigenous peoples became invisible in Canada, and I think they're still invisible, because people often make general statements about Canada that exclude the experience of Indigenous peoples. If we look, there's always been a lag between general principles that Canada has supported and the conduct of officials within the country. For example, Canada was one of the first signatories of the Charter of the United Nations, which begins with a very strong statement about human equality. The Charter of the United Nations came into effect in 1945. However, the Indian Act did not delete the exclusion of Indigenous peoples as persons until 1951. Canada was an enthusiastic signatory of the Genocide Convention in 1951. And the genocide